This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
It's 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. My name's Jacob.
Well, I must be Mercedes then. And we're on Community Radio 3CR with Friday Rave.
Yep, it's a Friday Rave again, and thanks to the wonders of modern technology, I'm sitting here in a thumping pig in a remote part of New South Wales, joined by Mercedes.
Hello.
In a part of the world, in Victoria.
Yeah, exactly. The wonders of modern technology. And I think we're probably going to learn about where some of that came from today. Is that right?
Well, yeah, it'll get there. I don't know if we'll go as far as the web, but I want to acknowledge that what's today? Today's the 8th of August, which means that Wednesday, the 6th of August, was the 80th anniversary. Well, commemoration. Anniversary is almost a celebratory thing. Commemoration of the dropping of the little boy Bob on Hiroshima. And tomorrow, of course, would be the dropping of Fat Man on Nagasaki. So last week we spoke about the uranium coming out of the Congo. I want to talk about this week, as we said, about some of the companies involved. And I'm just getting straight into it because, man, there are so many of these buggers that we need to talk about. But I'm going to start, before we even talk about the companies, I want to talk about, at the start of the Second World War, a bloke named Eugene Slizod is a Hungarian physicist, and he left Germany and then heard rumours of the Nazis working on a nuclear weapon. Now, this is a time when no one heard of nuclear weapons, obviously. And so then along with, his mates, other Hungarian physicists, Teller and Eugen Wigner, he tried to get the ear of the American government to say that they needed to develop this kind of weaponry before Germany got their hands on it. But Roosevelt, of course, was about 60 years old at the time, President Roosevelt. And it was a time of great technological change. You imagine, or I don't need to imagine, I am more than 60, but the kind of technology now, as compared to what you grew up with and what you cut your teeth on. And, he was Secretary of the Navy during World War One. And during World War One, they were just the ironclads. There was, they were mainly Gatling guns and Maxim guns being used and all that kind of stuff. He didn't know where to start. But nonetheless, he was a clever bloke. And so he enlisted the help of a bloke named Vannevar Bush, who is only distantly related to the presidential family. And Vannevar Bush is the founder of the company Raytheon, which is now RX. And anyway, he made Bush the director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development. And, he did things like invented modern radar. He did early work on computers. He was quite a technological genius. And he made him then the first administrator of the Manhattan Project, which was, of course, the project to build the bomb. So for a start, we've got Raytheon in there from day one. So they didn't know, as I was saying, they didn't know what they needed to do to build this bomb, because like Roosevelt, all the military were in their 60s and the top brass had no idea about physics, and nor should they. But so Bush got the engineer corps to establish a new division, the Manhattan Engineering Division, which had no geographical boundary, even though it was called the Manhattan one. And he began talking to companies about using their specialised areas. But it started getting bigger than Ben-Hur, obviously, and he appointed a bloke named Lieutenant Leslie Groves, who was an engineer who had just finished overseeing the construction of the Pentagon. And so Groves took control in 1942 and then recruited Robert Oppenheimer. And people have seen the film a couple of years ago, I think it was now, Oppenheimer, which was like just a bullshit film, quite frankly, because it was, for all the reasons, a whole Friday Rave could pull apart
the
that show.
The torment of Robert Oppenheimer.
The torment of Robert Oppenheimer, of course, casting him in the role of some kind of Greek tragic. But What basically happened was the Manhattan Project was split into more or less two distinct areas. The first one that Oppenheimer was overseeing was the science. But science itself doesn't make a bomb. I mean, the hard part's getting the building the thing, you know?
Getting the
So
pieces
Graves
together.
himself took control of the logistics and the construction. But anyway, first thing he did was he was given authority to, for a lot of money, spent millions and millions. The kind of dollars we're talking about, although we're talking about 30 million here, 20 million there, it sounds like nothing in today's terms, but for 1942 was a lot of, it was a lot of money. It's like talking billions in today's terms. And he set out building the Manhattan engineers, set it up building the ancillary buildings at a place called Oak Ridge in Tennessee, and then Los Alamos in New Mexico. But there were also others, Second Teddy in Connecticut, and no, Hartford in Connecticut. Second Teddy was in New Jersey, I think. So there was a lot of building. But to start with, they needed uranium. We've spoke about the uranium coming from the Belgian Congo. But even then, the uranium was just the ore, and they needed to get more than ore. So, but they got the ore from the Congo, they got a bit more from Canada, they got a bit more from Colorado, and then they needed to process the ore. Well, first I needed to get the ore to America. So just to concentrate on companies, we're talking about Pan Am, the American airline, which is now defunct, and the Barber Steamship Lines. And the Barber Steamship Lines become subsumed by the Norwegian firm Wilhelmsen Holding, which is now the largest maritime network in the world. At the time, it wasn't. The processing of the ore was undertaken initially by a mob called Vitro Manufacturing Company, which had been producing processing uranium to produce colored theater lighting. Vitro, through various acquisitions and all the rest of it, is now part of BAE Systems. And then another processor, particularly with the ore coming out of Colorado, was the Vanadium Corporation of America in Pittsburgh, where they use vanadium to make steel alloys, like they still do. And then those ores, after the first bit of processing, went through another series of processing by a mob called Lind Air Products. Now, Lind Air Products and Vitro were both divisions of Union Carbide, whose people have probably heard of, and they had another line of processing going through a mob called Electro Metallurgical Division. But anyway, Union Carbide were a huge US chemical company who were involved in all manner of military production, rocket fuels, explosives. Wherever the military industrial complex needed chemicals, Union Carbide were there. But you know, and people have heard of Union Carbide because their planet fucking activities weren't confined to the military. They were the company behind the Bhopal gas explosion in India in 84, the West Virginia gas leak in 85, and all the rest of it. Their plant in Sydney's Homebush Bay, and their plant in Plymouth, New Zealand, was where some of the Agent Orange used in Vietnam War was made. Though most of that was made by Monsanto, and I'll get to them in a minute. Union Carbide was bought out by Dow Chemicals, a similarly toxic US chemicals company. Now, Dow was behind most of the herbicides that have been since been shown to be poisonous, and manufacturers, of course, are the allegedly, I've got to say, exploding breast implants. I mean, these people, if there's a way to fuck people over and destroy people and the planet, these people do it. Companies like Dow, Union Carbide, Monsanto. Dow has since merged with Olin, which is one of the largest bleach manufacturer in the world, and also one of the largest munitions companies in the world. And then Union Carbide and Dow were both spun off. Their munitions factories were both spun off to DuPont. Back, that's now, but back in the
Everyone
day,
knows DuPont, yeah.
everyone knows DuPont. DuPont were reluctant to get involved in the beginning with the Manhattan Project because their sale of gunpowder to everybody in World War One was led to then being publicly described as war profiteers in the media. And that was affecting their sale of nylon, which DuPont invented. And nylon, of course, was mainly used for stockings in the interwar period.
A dual-use company, you might say.
Well, a dual-use company, exactly. You could say they've got a leg in either camp. But anyway, but then they needed all the nylon for parachutes. So they were trying to keep their public image clean. But they eventually took charge of overseeing the development of an enrichment plan that produced the plutonium needed for the Fat Man bomb. And they did that at their Hanford plant in Connecticut. Now, let me think. Now, I've got to say, I've mentioned Union Carbide, Dow Chemicals, their herbicide interests, and their Agent Orange connections, but you can't really talk about chemical fuckery and Agent Orange without mentioning Monsanto, who did a lot of the early polonium processing for the bomb, and they went on to make things like PCBs and glyphosates, and, you know, which made herbicides like Roundup, not to mention GMO crops. Monsanto has subsequently lost a lot of money due to its name being associated with everything bad, from PCBs to glyphosate, and they were eventually bought out by Bayer, who in turn were owned by IG Farber.
Mm.
Now, you think Monsanto had a bad name. IG Farber tried to clean up the name a bit because IG Farber, of course, you know, the worst thing they'd been involved in was probably just the mustard gas in World War One and the Zyklon B that was used in the concentration camps in World War Two. So it was nice to see such a clean German company trying to rehabilitate Monsanto's image. And Bayer, of course, the other thing they developed was a non-addictive alternative to morphine that they called heroin. So these people have been involved in fucking everything up. And they're at the very basis of processing the ore and the chemicals and the munitions of the Manhattan Project, and they still are. And then there was Kellex, and Kellex was a subsidiary of Kellogg, not the cornflakes mob, but the Kellogg is in Kellogg Brown Root, or KBR, and that was sold to Vitro. Where else am I going to go? They needed people with experience in dealing with heavy metals and toxic chemicals, and so they went to Kodak Eastman, you know, you've probably heard of as a photography and film company. And it was probably their experience with silver oxide that they knew how to separate heavy metals that led them into the project. And then they had to create, I'm running out of time, they had to create a whole lot of infrastructure. They used mobs like Alice Chalmers, who were building superchargers for planes and ships. And they built Alice built the infrastructure of the actual plants. And they, you know, much like a company like HTA in Campbellfield, they used to make agricultural machinery. And then they, through the Manhattan Project, the radiation therapy made them grow exponentially. And they split into a few companies. And Alice Chalmers Energy is still existent that supplies all the logistic services or a lot of logistic services for the oil and gas companies in the Gulf of Mexico. Exxon Valdez probably springs to mind there. You've probably heard of Chrysler as a car maker, but they were primarily a military contractor, and they were given $35 million to build the actual chambers. They ended up building so many of the diffusion chambers that original stock was still being used well into the 1980s. And Chrysler, ironically, have since been bought out by Mitsubishi, the company that was ground zero at the Nagasaki bombing, and now one of the biggest nuclear companies in the world as well.
And who, in more recent news, have just got the contract to build the frigates as part of the frigates.
Exactly. Yeah. Babcock and Wilcox, a company concerned with making boilers for industry, they made the casings for the tests and eventually the bomb casing themselves. They've been sold and now and reorganized and now operate as BWX, and they're still a big player in plant manufacture.
Can I just jump in with a question there? Babcock and Wilcox, is that Babcock any connection to the Babcock that it works alongside Leonardo for the choppers? Or is there no connection there?
I don't know. I haven't checked
All
that
right.
one out.
Maybe
We'll
that's
get
something
back
for
to you.
listeners to check in on.
Yeah, check in on that one. Where else are we going to go? We had Kodak Eastman. They did, as I said, at Oak Ridge, but they had to build a whole town around it. So that was what was done by a mob called Stone and Webster. And Stone and Webster were a huge contractor to the military. And it was actually said at the time that there was not a single military product in World War II that they weren't involved in. Now, that might have been hyperbole, but still the story is there. And they now exist as a part of Technic FMC that continues construction of the nuclear, gas, and oil industries. There's Westinghouse, who were already a major company in electrical production, and they used to make lamps using uranium. And they actually had an early process of trying to smash atoms in a shot tower in New Jersey. They provided all the electrical and electromagnetic equipment for the diffusion of Oak Ridge. And Westinghouse, of course, came to be one of the biggest nuclear companies in the world. They built the first full-scale reactor in 57. And just last month, they announced plans to build 10 new reactors in the US. May or may not happen, but they've been wining and dining President Trump and his cohorts a fair bit in recent months. Anyway, they're still doing it. There's Westinghouse Defense, was bought out by Northrop Grumman in the 90s, and we know who Northrop are. General Electric were there from the start. They were a company that was pretty much started by Thomas Edison. And after the bombs were dropped, they were involved in all kinds of processes to do with the nukes and electricity. But after the bomb was dropped, Leslie Groves made General Electric the primary contractor at the Hanford plant, which basically gave them the base to springboard their post-war nuclear activities. And they've been a major business in nuclear weapons since World War II. And in fact, I remember organising a screening of a short film about GE weapons production in the early 90s. And they've now merged their nuclear power division with the Japanese firm Hitachi. And that leaves, at the end of my bit of the rave, the actual delivery of the bombs. The planes, both the Enola Gay and on Hiroshima, and the boxcar that did the same to Nagasaki, were B-29 Super Fortress bombers made by Boeing. And Boeing, of course, still make bombers, including the Israeli Air Force's 707, their refueling aircraft that were used to refuel the bombers in air during their recent strikes on Iran. And Israel's 707s, of course, are also fitted out as in-flight command control communication centers. So while they're in the air, they're actually coordinating activities from the plane itself. So I just wanted to say that every last one of the companies involved in building the two nuclear bombs that were dropped on Japan 80 years ago, are still, whether directly or through the lineage of sales and acquisitions, involved in building weapons delivery platforms, delivering death and destruction, you could say. So when we hear Hiroshima, never again, what can you say? They're still doing it, the same people. But Mercedes, you were looking into some of the people involved, and I think we should give a just I'm going to close by giving a bit of a shout out. We listen to Community Radio 3CR 855 on your AM dial, or through all the W's on 3cr.org.au.
And you're listening to a Friday rave, if you couldn't tell already. But so yeah, Jake, talking about the companies, and I think that just we should mention that we're going to put this together as something, so people can read, because there's a lot in there. But also in the Manhattan Project in the 40s, we can't not mention IBM. So
Of
the
course.
Manhattan Project used early IBM punch card tabulators to calculate the yield of the atomic bombs. And so the predecessor of IBM's tabulation tech was the Hollerith tabulation system, which was developed in the 1880s by Herman Hollerith, who at the time was contracted by the US government to develop a system to conduct the census. So this same technology was also used to create racial profiles in the census, employed along the lines of white supremacy in the US. It was used to track troop data in Normandy, in World War II, and also was used to collect data on potential insurgents in the Cold War in Vietnam. IBM's technology, with the devout Nazi Willy Hardiger at the head of IBM in Germany, was used to run the Nazi death labor camps, and the technology was used both to determine the yield of an atomic bomb and was also used by the Nazis in the Holocaust. Is the precursor, that technology is a precursor to the modern surveillance systems and predictive analysis that we see today. So IBM today operates Israel's ATAN system for population regulation, controlling the military checkpoints and data on Palestinians in Palestine. It's got a full subsidiary called Red Hat Israel that works extensively with the Israeli military and almost wholly, and they provide the computing and software-based storage data centers to multiple units of the Israeli military. That includes OpenShift Cloud Network and the surveillance data systems, which provide the information and the platforms for AI targeting and tracking. IBM itself, not through its subsidiary, but itself works with the Israeli military also to develop the defense tech pathways for former members of Unit 8200 to develop the tech startup, some of which we've spoken about on the show before. So IBM's complicity in genocide from World War II and before and today is long and extensive, and I definitely look it up. Now, another person you mentioned, the bombs that were dropped by the Enola Gay, John von Neumann was the person who was tasked to determine the precise calculations for the altitude above Hiroshima and Nagasaki from which the bombs would have to be dropped to kill the maximum amount of people as possible. Now, John von Neumann, after World War II, would go on to work with the Rand Corporation. And his work with the Rand Corporation would develop, among other things, the prisoner's dilemma, which is a game theory which has really largely theorized and determined the trajectory of the nuclear arms race and arms races in general. And I just want to mention the Rand Corporation, which a lot of listeners might be aware of, but the Rand Corporation, there was a representative of the Rand Corporation that were part of the Australia-US Defence Dialogues as part of, alongside HTA's Karen Stanton, as part of the Get a USA Defence Dialogues in October last year.
Boo hiss.
Another person involved was Herb York. And so Herb York was recruited to the Manhattan Project in 1943 at Berkeley under Ernest O. Lawrence. Herb York produced the uranium in Lawrence's invention called the cyclotron, which would eventually end up in both the Little Boy and Fat Man bombs. He then went on to work alongside Lawrence and Edward Teller as chief scientists at the Livermore Laboratory, which developed the Castle Bravo, and they were really pushing and gunning for the development of a 10,000 megaton bomb that would, quote, eliminate an entire continent and contaminate the Earth. So this notoriety, if you could call it that, would lead him to the Pentagon in 1958 to meet with the then Secretary of Defense, James McElroy, to negotiate the position of chief scientist at a new research facility and McElroy's brainchild, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, known as ARPA, or what's now known as DARPA. There was another candidate for the top job of chief scientist at ARPA, and that is Werner von Braun, who you probably heard of before. And at the time, Wernher von Braun had just successfully launched the US's first successful satellite and, who we now know, was also an officer in the Nazi SS and was brought to the US after World War II alongside 113 of his Nazi collaborators under Operation Paperclip. Now, von Braun wouldn't join ARPA without securing a position for a bunch of his Nazi scumbag mates. And so Herb York, who produced the uranium for the atomic bomb, and McElroy not really, you know, feeling it was politically expedient for him to recruit Nazis in the initial stages. Herb York became the chief scientist of the U.S. Military Research Agency. And he also, I think it's in, would be, we need to mention that on a vote afterwards on to ban nuclear weapons, Herb York abstained from the vote. He did say later that he preferenced to vote no, but thought it would be more politically expedient for him to abstain. And because his fear was that the Livermore project that he worked on with the likes of Lawrence and Teller would be over and his dreams of making a bomb that would wipe out millions of people in the interest of American superiority would, in a disgusting paradox, disappear.
Now, I just got to add another paradox there. We talk about a lot of these scientists at the start of the project, Slyzer, Teller, Wagner, Hungarian, there are a lot of Hungarians involved. This bloke was a Mohawk Indian. Anyway, that's just a by the by.
By the by, who's that?
York.
York.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
York was a Mohawk Indian. Be that as it may, anyway.
Be that as it may. Well, you mentioned Edward Teller before. So Edward Teller, after the Manhattan Project, would go on to advise Israel alongside Oppenheimer on building up their plutonium reserves and was a really important advisor to Israel's development of hydrogen bombs. So all the while, as he was doing that, Edward Teller was a member of the Zionist entity called PEACE, standing for the Preventing the Emergence of Another Arab Country in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. And that was a group that directly supported the Zionist militias and entities in Israeli settlements in the West Bank, in Gaza, and Palestine.
Straight out of Orwell's playbook, maybe, that one.
Yeah. And, of course, Manhattan Project, as we see all these companies of where they've come, you know, where they've come together, where they were really sort of solidified, their roles in the military industrial complex was solidified. It was also a revolving door. It's a revolving door, which we see happening through government, through private corporations. And so out of the Manhattan Projects, a group of scientists and protégés of the evil assholes that we've already mentioned, they got together to form a for-profit defense consulting group called Theoretical Physics Incorporated. And so this was headed by four scientists who cut their teeth in the Manhattan Project, namely Murph Goldberger, Kenneth Watson, Keith Bruckner, and Murray Gell-Mann, among others. So the group took their consulting knowledge to ARPA in the hope that ARPA would fund their for-profit enterprise, and it did. So while offering to gather a team to work alongside ARPA in the consulting field, however, to remain somewhat quote-unquote separate from the Pentagon and to also cut the bureaucracy and the red tape of the government of a government project, their funding came through the Institute of Defense Analyses, which was a federally funded research center whose only customer was the Department of Defense. So using all of their connects from the Manhattan Projects, the group called themselves the Jason Project, borrowing from Greek mythology of Jason and the Argonauts. And I think, you know, the penchant for these assholes to use names borrowed from mythological figures persists with companies like Palantir and Anduril.
So, and Palantir and Anduril, of course, are modern theology, the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So Jason went on, we're almost out of time, but Jason went on to get top secret defense clearance and continued to operate as one of the most secretive yet influential advisory groups for the next five decades. So I guess today, the bringing in the likes of Edward Teller and others into the fold in that Jason Project as part of that top secret mission. So it's not just the government and the private corporations that solidified the military-industrial complex, but the consultancy groups also get a chop out. And I feel like there's a lot of information and we kind of put it together. But what we know is the military-industrial complex today was really like formulated, and it was Eisenhower that's, you know, that has spoken about it, really formulated what the military industrial complex is and how we see it persisting today. And on the 80th commemoration of those bombs dropping on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, from then, and as you said, we say never again, but this is where we are.
This is where we are, folks. But that's all we've got time for.
That is all we've got time for. You're tuned to 3CR Community Radio. As we said, we'll put this into some form of writing so you can read it because it's a lot to take in. Stay tuned for Radio MMT and you're tuned to Community Radio 3CR, and we'll talk to you next week. We might even bring some recent defence news because we haven't spoken about that in a little while.
Yeah, exactly. You think it's all history, but anyway.
Anyway. All right. Catch you next week. We'll be right back.